Welcome to Real Vision. It's Wednesday, October 14th, and you're watching The Daily Briefing. Soon, I'll be speaking to our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, how are companies thinking about returning to the office during the coronavirus pandemic? Let's go to Peter Cooper, who's got the story. Peter?
Thanks, Jack. Numerous U.S. companies that currently have their employees working remotely and were planning to return to the office in early 2021 have pushed back their plans of reopening their physical office locations further to the summer of 2021. As the pandemic persists throughout the end of the year, the uncertainty surrounding the development of a vaccine and fears how the winter will increase risk of exposure are prompting companies like Google, Uber, Slack, and Airbnb to postpone their return to the office to the summer. Microsoft, Target, and Ford Motors have also announced in the past week of their intent to postpone. The risk of infection is always prevalent in some capacity for people who venture outside of their homes. And investment banks such as JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs last month sent some workers back home after some employees had tested positive for the virus when trying to reinstate some form of in-person work. As such, many businesses are preferring to tread carefully. Not only are businesses delaying the return of in-person work, many are also organizing permanent work-from-home options for their employees. We have mentioned on this show earlier in the year when Facebook and Twitter made these announcements, but Coinbase, Shopify, and now Microsoft has joined them as well. Management across many businesses is finding that the transition to work-from-home life has made their employees much more efficient and productive workers, which to many has come as a surprise and leaves company executives more open to the idea of implementing remote work as a normal feature of work life even past the pandemic. However, many workers are struggling with the lack of the social element that an office is well suited for. Slack, as an example, had completed a survey of their staff measuring their satisfaction with remote work. While many reported satisfaction with their work arrangements and work-life balance, Slack employees overall believe there is a lesser sense of belonging in the company, as remote meetings and interactions can only do so much. 11.6% of Slack employees reported wanting to return to full-time office work, while 72.2% would prefer a hybrid of in-office and remote work. So while there will be a lot of pain in the coming months for the commercial real estate market as businesses keep postponing their plans to return to the office, the physical office may not yet be dead if the trend veers towards this blend of in-person and remote work in the coming years. And with that, I'll hand it back to you, Jack.
Thanks, Peter. Welcome, Ed. How are you doing?
Good. Jack Farley in the house. You know, this is time number two for you. I'm really excited to do this. You know, a lot of people gave you props the last time that you were leading the charge here.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here. You know, it's funny, Peter mentioned going back to the office. I actually am in the office myself. I have to give Max the Bloomberg terminal, who's got to make a few charts. So yeah, I'm reporting from the Real Vision New York City headquarters, and I'm glad to be with you. Ed, what are you looking at in the markets? I feel like there's so much to discuss, but what do you want to start with?
Yeah, actually, you know, we were talking a little bit about what we were going to discuss, and I'm thinking banks in particular, because we had two or three banks come out today. I think it was Wells, Goldman Sachs, and then we also had B of A. And then yesterday, you talked to Ash for a long time, I saw, about Citi and JP Morgan. And I think that it's definitely a tale of the K-shaped recovery in certain ways, if you will, with JP Morgan mostly on the upside of that. I would say that, you know, if you look at, as you were saying in your analysis, net operating income, you know, net interest margins, you have one side, which was yesterday, Citi, and then today more B of A and Wells Fargo, which are more dependent upon the consumer and net interest margins. They're not doing as well. But the guys who are more trading oriented, like JP Morgan, which isn't completely trading oriented, but Goldman Sachs certainly is. I mean, they had much better earnings. And Goldman Sachs today had ridiculously off the chart beat of expectations, almost double earnings per share compared to what people expected.
Absolutely. I actually went through Goldman's report today, and I was trying my hardest not to be impressed, and I just couldn't manage it. They had the highest return on equity since 2010, year-over-year growth in all four reporting segments. That's global markets, investment banking, consumer banking, and asset management. Within global markets, FIC revenues, that's fixed income currency commodities, revenues at $2.5 billion. That's down from the second quarter when we had a record, explosion in bonds because of the Fed. So we've had a little bit of decline in volumes, but it's still up 49% year over year compared to 2019 in the third quarter. And also, you know, it's fixed income, credit, and commodities, but it includes mortgages as well. As I was reading today, mortgage-backed securities issuance is up over 100% year over year. So you could tie in that residential real estate boom as well. There's the net interest margin angle. All five banks which reported the past 5 days reported a compression in the spread between the rate at which they lend and the rate at which they themselves are lent to. One thing that struck me, Ed, that I want to get your opinion on is within the investment banking division of Goldman, equity underwriting is at a very robust $850 million because of a flurry of IPOs. Debt underwriting is down a bit, but one thing that really is just off the chart, I could barely see it on the chart, is corporate lending, which was a mere $35 million. This goes to something that you and I have been following for a while, which is that companies are beginning to pay down debt. Do you think that that is a good thing or a bad thing for the economy?
Well, it is an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that number. I would say that we're seeing a certain degree of credit restriction going forward, and the fact that we had all this debt build up before, I think, was as a result of the liquidity crisis. So, people had record cash in their balance sheet, including banks, actually. Goldman Sachs and the big banks, they have a record number of treasuries and cash and cash equivalents on their balance sheet relative to, the last 15 years. So now that the liquidity crisis is over and we have daylight in terms of going forward, I was saying always, look at the September, October timeframe as when you get that daylight, we're seeing people pay down. That they say, okay, the worst is over. The look forward is not great, but we feel that we can pay down some of this debt and move forward.
Mm. Yeah, Ed, going back to something you said earlier about the K-shaped nature of the recovery, about how they're the bifurcation between winners and losers. Can you tell us a little bit more and go in a little bit greater depth about investment banks versus commercial banks and how those different institutions are being affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, so I think that, the K-shape, you see it all over the place. I'm going to talk to you at some point in this about the credit cycle, but you see it in the consumer side, and you see it also in terms of the investment banks. So I think it's a sign of the financialization of the economy in terms of supporting asset prices while it's relatively weak in terms of what's happened in the real economy. So the banks that are more oriented towards the real economy, towards consumers, they're doing less well than the ones that are geared towards the financial economy, like Goldman Sachs. I would expect the same thing to come out of Morgan Stanley when they report shortly. And JP Morgan, they are also much more geared towards big, sales and trading, all sorts of mergers and acquisition and corporate lending than, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, or Citigroup. So my expectation is that Morgan Stanley will continue in that vein. So we see that bifurcation. The real question is it priced in, and what happens to the economy going forward? I think it's definitely priced in. I did see, however, something that was interesting that said that JP Morgan, the stock trades at 1.5 times tangible book, which is a big premium to Goldman. But when you look at the price earnings ratios, all of the companies that are more leveraged to the financial economy, like Goldman, trade at earnings PE ratios that are superior to the other companies. So you have Goldman up here. You have JP Morgan below, and then the price earnings ratio of Citi is much worse than those two. So I do think that it's actually priced in, and if you have some sort of reversion from the K, then you're going to see Goldman underperform relative to the likes of JP Morgan.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, just tell me about that potential reversion. I feel like the past two quarters have been really a once-in-a-lifetime event for fixed income traders and people on the equity desk who are meeting the needs of these corporations that need financing, as well as that system being buoyed by the Federal Reserve. Do you think that thing will last? Because, you know, already, even though Goldman is reporting these record numbers, they're trading profits and revenues are down from the last quarter. So already we're seeing a decline. What do you think? Do you think this K-shape will last, or do you think we will see a reversion, as you said earlier?
Yeah, I think we're already seeing the reversion. You talked about this maybe, I think it was last week, where you talked about the credit, how 90% of the downgrades were in the triple C space. So, you know, you see a massive amount of distress at the lower end of the credit spectrum. I think that we're seeing that pull through. And so eventually I think that it's going to move up the chain. You know, what I would say is that people, when they're thinking about the markets and they're thinking about what the markets are signaling, I tend to look at it in terms of the market signaling the real economy as opposed to the political economy. You know, so some people might say that, you know, the markets are reacting in real time to XYZ event in the political economy or on the ground. I think that the longer wave is really about, you know, the economy leading markets and therefore leading the politics. Let me give you an example, because I think I sent you this chart earlier. An example would be, some people are talking about that Trump, he came out of the coronavirus problem relatively unscathed. He went to the hospital, came out 3 days later. He's back in the campaign trail. You know, that could be bullish for the economy. It could be bullish for markets. I definitely don't see that. I know that Tony Greer, as an example, he was talking about that yesterday. I tend to think that, take a look at some of these charts that I, maybe we can put these up onto the screen here. If you look at over the last, say, 60 years in terms of elections. This chart here, it shows you, you know, the polls in terms of how far you have to go versus the poll in terms of the actual outcome of the election. And what you see actually is the difference between Biden and Trump is actually greater than any of these numbers. So if Trump were to actually win the election in November, it would be the greatest comeback in the history of the United States in post-World War II electoral history. So the concept that the markets are trading on a Trump train doesn't wash for me. And it doesn't wash for me in general, because I don't believe that the markets are leveraged to the political economy anyway. What I think is happening is that the forward-looking part of the economy looks good because of this K. But there is, to a degree, a fly in the ointment in terms of what I would consider a reversion towards a generalized distress. So the K has, you know, one group going up. That's the Goldmans relative to the Citigroups. That is certain sectors of the economy relative to others. What you need to and then what you could see is you could see this group move up towards the other group, or you could see the gap closed by this group moving down. Let me give you an example of how I'm thinking about it in terms of the credit cycle. So the credit cycle, if you look at the 2020 defaults by industry, that 70% of the defaults so far in 2020 have been in four places. They've been in consumer products, they've been in oil and gas, They've been in retail and restaurants, and then they've been in media and entertainment. I think you were already talking about AMC last week. You know, we know what's going on in oil and gas, and we know what's going on in retail, et cetera. That's where the distress is. 70% of defaults are in that region. If that number shrinks, then to me, that's a sign that, you know, this K, the gap is closing with the companies, the sectors of the economy that are doing relatively well, moving down in that direction toward the K guys. What you really want to see is you want to see the four, the consumer products people, the oil and gas, the restaurants and retail, and the media and entertainment moving up. And so that's sort of my forward-looking thinking about where the markets are. They're not there yet. They're not sussing that out. But I think that's where markets are forward looking, not about the presidential election, but rather how the economy is doing and what the credit cycle is saying.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, just quickly on the K shape. I think last week I was talking about with Ash that the movie chain Cineworld would shut down all of its operations, and it, I think, needs still waiting on a $300 to $500 million debt offering in the fixed income markets. But yeah, AMC today, I saw in the Axios piece we were chatting about, AMC as of October 9th, it's resumed operations in 494 of its 598 theaters, but their ticket sales are down 85% on a year-over-year basis. So these companies definitely are facing immense hurdles. And by the way, Delta today reported a $5.4 billion loss for the quarter. But Ed, let's go back to the credit markets. You've got in your credit write-downs piece, you've got a plurality of charts. I know you mentioned the one about across which industries, but what else are you seeing in credit markets, both looking back historically as well as looking forward?
Yeah, so one chart that I thought was interesting. Actually, there are two charts I'd talk to. Let's first talk to let's talk about that AMC thing that you were talking about. So here's a chart. It's the global corporate default summary, and it shows that, you know, more of the defaults are happening in the U.S. 6.3% 12-month trailing junk bond default rate versus, say, 4.3% in Europe. And I would postulate that that dichotomy, a lot of it has to do with the safety net that is being provided for corporates in Europe versus the one that is being provided in the United States, which is more porous in the U.S. So, and also to date, the U.S. has performed relatively less well in terms of coronavirus. But going forward, the question is what do those numbers look like? Most people are prognosticating the numbers rise more prodigiously for the United States and for Europe. I think the question is who rises more? At this point, people are saying it's the U.S. I would agree with that. And then that gets into the question of, you know, how much of that leaks into the rest of the economy. So with that K closing by these guys staying high and not staying high, but, you know, they're going low and these guys staying low, the K-shaped part of that. The second thing is I think when you think about the credit cycle generally leads as opposed to follows. And so I'm looking to see how steep the curve is in terms of the downgrade prospects going forward in the wake of sort of this consolidation phase that we're in right now. So the chart I had showed the credit cycle from 2000 to 2019. And I would point out, I would say, three different parts of this chart. So what you see in the chart is the U.S., Europe, other developed economies in the emerging markets. Focusing on the one line, the U.S., which is the light blue line, what you'll notice is that the light blue line slopes upward starting in 2000 when the recession began in March of 2001. So the credit cycle, the downgrades actually already started to happen in a very aggressive way. The next time you saw that upward slope being aggressive, it was really aggressive, and that was in 2007. And that also predated the December 2007 top of the market. That's when the recession happened, December 2007. Then the third thing that I would point out is in 2014, when the shale oil bust happened, you saw an upward slope to the downgrades that was about on par with the upward slope that you saw in 2000. And so on some level, you could have expected a potential recession there, but it was very localized in oil and gas, and it never metastasized out to the rest of the economy. Now, we don't see this line because it's this chart that I was looking at cuts off at 2019. I see a similar sort of effect in the sense that we have a massively upsloping line, and that line is predominantly within those four segments that I talked about. To the degree that you see it metastasize into other parts of the economy, then we would get a double dip recession, as opposed to the recovery that we're now in continuing on.
Yeah, it's a really interesting chart. At first, I thought that on the y-axis was credit spreads, but it's actually the prospect of a default. Speaking of credit spreads, Tyler Neville, my credit arch nemesis, he, like clockwork today, he texted me a chart of high yield spreads at their lowest that they've been since February. And he said, from the Farley camp, crickets. So Ed, what can you please empower me with an argument so I can go back to Tyler and have something to say? You know, credit spreads, as Tyler says, are at record lows, and if they are a leading indicator, doesn't that suggest that we have a boom for at least several more months?
I wouldn't say several more months, but definitely at least a few. So I think that the markets are basically telling you it's all clear. There's nothing on the horizon in the immediate future that says distress has metastasized in a way that imperils the economy. But if those numbers start to go up, we're talking credit spreads, we're talking downgrades, we're talking about the K moving so that it goes outside of the 70% being in those four sectors. All of those things are signs that there's leakage into the rest of the economy. So if you take a look at the dichotomy between 2000, 2007, and 2014, the big difference in 2014 was it was localized in one particular area. If it becomes unlocalized in this particular juncture, then we should see it be reflected in credit spreads more generally. And we should also see other indications that things are starting to hot up. So I still see it as a canary in the coal mine. And by the way, in terms of my call that this is a potential double dip, I did mention when I was writing about it today that the NBER, when they called the February 2020 peak, they said that the committee concluded that the subsequent drop in activity had been so great and so widely diffused throughout the economy that even if it proved to be quite brief, the downturn should be classified as a recession. You can take that same logic and then you could apply it to the recovery. The V-shape that we saw to the level that we had recently is enough so that we could say that we're definitely in recovery, and anything that happens now is another recession. And that other recession has to be of the same ilk that the NBER was talking about. They were saying that so great and so widely diffused, and we're not there yet. So I would go back to Tyler and basically say that, we're not there yet, but it is a mean reverting series. We're at the low. You could almost say that it's almost a contrary indicator in that it's just waiting to percolate up. But as we speak, there's no sign that that's happening.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think if you look at the chart of credit spreads, just at the simple chart, it's very hard to see stress, and it's just not there. I think if you look a little bit beyond the surface into some of the more illiquid assets, you start to see a few cracks in the system. For example, I was just looking through the Bank of America's report today, and their percentage of non-performing loans is at 0.48%. That's up from 0.44% last quarter and 0.36% in the third quarter of 2019. So that ticks up. Commercial reservable criticized utilized exposure, which is a very long-term phrase for basically sour loans, that's ticking up as well. For 6.6% has been deemed to be a little bit spotty by the FDIC. That's significant as well. I want to end, Ed, by talking about Jamie Dimon's comments.
Oh, yeah, that's where I wanted to go too. Yes.
We're on the same page. Tell me, Ed, because I read the report and I went through the numbers, but I really haven't seen his commentary. So what did Jamie Dimon say, and why is it significant?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, so I mean, when you were talking about, I think you were talking about B of A and you went through their stuff and you saw upticks and so forth. If you looked through the numbers at JP Morgan, their loan loss provisioning was less than people expected. They preserved less. Provisioned less this quarter, and their numbers were off the charts good relative to expectations. But interestingly, Jamie Dimon, you know, when he got on the call, he said, this is a direct quote, he said, compared to the first quarter, our reserve build now assumes a more protracted downturn as we prepare and reserve for something worse than our base case. So basically what he's saying is, yes, we had a recession, and yes, we had less loan loss provisioning now because we're in a recovery. We just exited the V-shaped part of the recovery, but we're now entering into a less steep upturn, and you don't know if that's going to roll over. We're thinking that this is a more protracted event. And when he says protracted downturn, he actually means a depression. He's not talking about a recession, because at some point in his commentary, he talks about a double dip. And so those two are very distinct. He's saying recession one, upturn, and then a double dip into the second, all part of one longer depression-like experience. So that's a sort of, I would call, a worst case scenario, because he always talks about his fortress balance sheet. He's really, preparing them for the potential for downside risk. The second thing he said that I thought he said was, quote, you will see the effect of this recession. You're just not going to see it right away because of all the stimulus. And so what he was basically saying is that the only reason that we saw such a V shape is because the stimulus was so huge. This gets back to what David Rosenberg has been saying for a long time. The stimulus was actually bigger than the lost revenue. So, we were able to continue that holding pattern by and large because people were made whole. A lot of people were made whole or made more than whole. But that stimulus is now rolling off. I heard rumors about the Republicans, setting the stage for fiscal austerity going forward. One of the reasons that they're not down with the Democrats right now under Trump is because they actually think that Trump's going to lose. This is a report that's coming out of Bloomberg. The Republicans in the Senate think that Trump is going to lose, and so they're not going to give away on expanding the deficit now, knowing that if they hold the line now, they can say legitimately in January, February, if Biden were to become the president, look, we already started, we've had enough of all these deficits. We said this under Trump. That's why we didn't go for it in October, November, and we're not going to go for it with you, Joe Biden. So that's sort of where things are potentially headed going forward. That makes the outlook a little bit murkier. It's not in the numbers as we see it. The market is still pricing in, a good forward pattern, but there are some risks out there, and Jamie Dimon was pointing them out.
Yeah, Ed, that's really interesting. We only have a few minutes left, but I just want to quickly zoom in on the fiscal stimulus, because so often, I read articles about the fiscal stimulus, and it's so rare that I actually feel like I learned something new from reading it. But you've been following this story. It seems like a consensus is forming that a significant stimulus bill will likely not be passed before November 3rd. My first question for you is, do you agree with that? And my second question for you is, We've been reading that since August that the $600 a month unemployment assistance being turned off would negatively impact markets, yet it hasn't really happened. When, if ever, do you think a shoe will drop on that?
Yeah, so here's what I think is being priced in now, to the degree that there's any pricing in from a political perspective. I think what's being priced in is that, yes, there's no stimulus now, but the stimulus roll-off won't be so aggressive as to create some sort of recession, double dip, and that when 2021 comes around, whoever's in office, and likely it's going to be Biden, given the numbers that we've seen, there's going to be stimulus at that point in time. The caveat there, I would say, there are multiple caveats. Number one, in terms of where the position is now, Trump, he wants to be reelected, so he's going for stimulus. He's already said $1.8 trillion. The House has said, we want stimulus too, and we actually want more than you do because we think that we've understimulated. We want $3 trillion. The Senate, which is the Republicans, they're only looking for a small bill. They're trying to position themselves for, we're not going to go for deficit spending anymore. This is crap. Because if Biden wins, and we think that he will, given the polls, we want to position ourselves for making that call. If we hold the Senate in the election in November, then we can make it painful for Biden when he becomes the president. So that is the fly in the ointment for 2021, were Biden to become the president. And the second point is that it's really all about output. One thing that David Rosenberg has talked about is what he calls inventory restocking. So really what we're seeing is the inventories got incredibly low, and now we're now restocking those inventories. It's just like we saw in China in the beginning of their recovery. So it's not really that consumption is the all-consuming aspect, no pun intended.
Right,
it's really that GDP is a production number. Production product. That's what they're measuring. And so if you produce more, if you increase inventory, so to speak, then you can still have a higher GDP number. So it hasn't shown up in GDP. The real question is, are we going to see the follow through on the consumer? And I think that we're going to have that question answered somewhere towards the end of the year and the beginning of next year, when all of these decisions about holiday spending and also fiscal stimulus get made. And we have a fiscal cliff that's happening on December the 31st to boot. So to be continued, basically.
Yeah, to be continued. There's so much more to discuss, but we'll have to end it there. Ed, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope the Real Vision members do as well.
Yeah, Jack, great to talk to you as host. Great second go round.
Oh, thank you.